Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Everyone, thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you are new to our podcast, I encourage you to go back and listen to some of our previous guests over the last 100. This is 161st episode, and they have great thoughts to share around becoming a better leader and lessons that they've learned throughout their careers. This week, we're revisiting a conversation that we had some time ago with Lindy Greer. Lindy is an associate professor at the Ross School of Business, and she has been selected as one of the top 40 under 40 business school professors. And she has focused her career on how to design and lead effective organizational teams. And looking forward to today's conversation with Lindy. We're happy to have Lindy joining us this morning. And Lindy, I guess, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your background, a little bit of your story?
So I'm a social psychologist by training, but I work in the business school now. And so my research and my teaching is at that intersection of business and psychology. I believe a lot of the human experience can be improved by better understanding how to relate with people at work. And so in a sense, that's my life's mission. I focus specifically on team dynamics and leadership within that area. I just believe there's a lot of power for business as well as just, you know, thriving in life to understand how to navigate those types of relationships at work.
How did you, early on in your career, did you always want to teach? And tell us a little bit about just kind of that journey to what you're doing now.
Yeah, at least for me, growing up in a lower socioeconomic status household, like I didn't know professors. I never knew that was a job or even an option.
Sure.
And then I was very fortunate to get into Wharton undergrad. And while I was there, I was work study to pay my way through. And I randomly looked into a job with a professor there who did research on conflict and teams my freshman year and got exposed to professor life and business research the very first time and just fell in love with it. I'd always wanted to go do something like, you know, human rights law and save the world. But then if you think about the positive impact you can make at, like, for example, teaching people how to resolve conflicts at work, everybody benefits from those types of skills. And so I worked with her all 4 years through undergrad. And then she was the first woman to get tenure in the management department in the Netherlands. And after tenure decided that she was going to go move to Europe to psychology and have a new life. And so she moved to Europe, the Netherlands, my third year. And so I ended up following her there to do my PhD. And so I was grew up in academia in sort of a weird place where I was in the system, but not in the system. Because I was working with someone who's very well known among the business school world here, but in the Netherlands, in this totally new world for, you know, American business school academia at that time. Worked with her my whole way through, ended up staying in the Netherlands for the first part of my career, and then got headhunted back to Stanford and then on to Michigan.
Okay, great. Well, tell us a little bit, you know, I love to ask this question of every guest. If you were to go back knowing what you know now and talk to a 22-year-old Lindy, what advice would you give her?
Don't give up. The academia is, I think, one of the most ruthless professions in many ways. It's every professor is an individual entrepreneur. And there's more failure than there is success. Your papers get rejected. People don't like your presentation. It's very difficult. And at least for me, like during my PhD, when I was 22 to 25, like I had so many papers rejected from journals in a row over and over and over. And at least at this point now, looking back on my career and looking at others in my career who have succeeded, it's all about just persistence and not giving up and one foot in front of the other and just keep going. And as long as you do that and you love what you do in our profession, you can succeed. And I think I needed that message a little bit more when I was 22. And I think most people do, to realize that if you just could keep on going and find that resiliency, anything's possible. And, you know, especially right now within the Leadership Center, as we're trying to help people through COVID and leadership skills, it makes me realize that right now, resiliency is probably one of the most important skill sets you can have across any profession, be it academia or otherwise.
Talk a little bit about the Leadership Center and just some of the work that you're doing around, I know we talked a little bit about the idea of coaching yourself. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit and kind of expand that?
I'm really happy to share what we've been working on. Leadership development, you know, if you're looking at it as a business strategy can be quite costly for business school. Either you need to have a gazillion faculty who teach a gazillion courses or have a huge coaching staff on call. It's expensive, and like, you know, some of that you can question the effectiveness. And so for me, like after a year in the center, it's like, okay, how can we do more on leadership development at Ross in a way that has deep impact, creates connections, and is efficient in what we do? And so this year we launched what we're calling the Standard Leadership Journey, which is a self-coaching program for students where on their own and in support of peer coaching groups, they're able to take ownership over their own leadership development. And I'm really excited about this because whether, you know, both at Ross but also outside, it offers a way to scale leadership development across universities as well as companies in a way that I think can create deeper change than traditional methods of leadership development. So we've launched sort of a five-step program, if you will, over, you know, bringing traditional coaching methods into a basically a self-help program where students set the bigger picture goal of what they want to be working on and then try to identify, okay, what are the leadership tools, the skills that I need to acquire today, tomorrow, and next month in order to achieve that dream 2 years down the road? And how can I intentionally then work on these tools, but also find tools that are scientifically driven and not just like guruism or whatever, because the more intentional you are, not just about getting better at leadership, but knowing what exact evidence-backed skill you're working on, the better you do. So our Leadership Center has launched a website that has like a do-it-yourself leadership manual. We also have launched peer coaching groups within the MBA program where they each week get a little bit of new information and behaviors to work on, and they work with each other to say, hey, you know, your goal this week was to be more inclusive, which means asking more questions in meetings. How did that go? What was hard? What were the roadblocks? How would you do it again? And then as students want to go further and like start to find new behaviors on their own, we launched the world's first ever encyclopedia of data-driven leader behaviors on our website this past week. And I is perhaps one of the most geekily exciting things I think I've ever done in my career. And it's amazing. So like if you go to the Sainer website and you say, okay, like I say, I want, like based on the conversation today, like, oh, I want to go work on my resiliency skills or the green growth skills in our Michigan model of leadership, you can sort on the website. Immediately get back 20 one-liners of behaviors you could do that week, but then it links out to the scientific citation. And so it's you are able to get the academic rigor to say, okay, like it has been scientifically proven with multiple laboratory studies that if you get more sleep at night, you communicate more effectively with your team. So this week, if you want to be a more resilient and effective leader, get your sleep. And then you can, you know, and then on our website, we have a tracking book for you to track these experiments to say, okay, this week, that was the thing I focused on. As I tried to get more sleep, I caught, you know, collected data to say, hey, like, did my team meetings go more smoothly when I was more well-rested? Yes or no, what could I do differently? And then you could track that. And then in our tracking sheet, you can choose a new behavior the next week or maybe revise the current behavior. And then over time, start to reflect. And then we're offering opportunities then to coach other people because that's sort of the highest step of learning. Is, you know, how do you take what you're doing to support others on their journey? So that's the Sainer Leadership Journey. We launched it with the MBA program this year in depth and are also offering a lot more leadership opportunities during the year, sort of milestones for them to help check themselves and how they're doing. And the goal will be to start to expand that to the other programs at Ross over the next few years.
So is there a certain area that seems to be with most of the students that go through this program seems to be the biggest gap? Is there particular areas that you find is a common thread, or is it kind of across all the areas?
So we often use the Michigan model of leadership as a framework, which has like the four colors of yellow in people skills, red in processes and structure, blue is in goal setting and achievement, and green is in growth and flexibility. Mm-hmm. Across that, it's fairly evenly distributed, honestly, among our student body, which is great. That shows the diversity that we have. If you get into like more specific or granular skills, I think most MBA students come to an MBA program for polishing, you know, on things like executive presence, of making it to the next level of thinking strategically about not just maybe managing one or two direct reports, but managing a larger team or a larger organization. And so I think across the board, that is always going to be in high demand from recruiters of our students, as well as for the students themselves, over just how do I make it to that next level of leadership? And where a lot of that is going to be moving from, like if you teach leadership to your undergrads, they're just, okay, how do I manage conflicts? You know, how do I get along with other people at work? It was the entry level. And for the MBAs, it's a little bit more strategic and a little bit more executive presence.
Okay. So this is a definitely an interesting time to to be living, and there's a lot of uncertainty that's in everybody, and every executive I'm talking to is dealing with a lot of unknowns. How do you manage during this time? What are some of the things that you you talk about as far as managing an uncertainty?
Yeah, it's funny. So at least within my leadership center, we joke that this is a year of green in the Michigan model. So even if some of us were green already, like this is a year where that needs to become all of our superpower of how do you develop the resiliency and adaptiveness to go with whatever 2020 is going to throw at us. And I'm working with companies right now too. I think there's a lot of that over just whether it's a global pandemic, growing awareness around racial justice, et cetera. Like there's a lot of really big challenges, and it's almost at this point, like what's going to be next week? So for myself and for Saner and for what I'm seeing with executive audiences, resiliency and adaptiveness are huge. There's a lot of things, behaviors you can work on within that, that I myself am working on too, over just how do you, you know, regularly get feedback, because that's the only way to be adaptive and grow, and how do you build feedback mechanisms in around you. Like within my leadership center today, this afternoon, we're doing quick speed dating where we have asked each other for feedback on something and then getting feedback over, oh, how is that behavior coming across in meetings? How well did it go in managing the project planning for that specific project? So feedback, self-care more generally, like the article I mentioned on sleep, like broadly stated, there's a lot we can do in terms of our life outside of work that makes us more adaptive at work. Especially with working at home and COVID and everything else, I think, you know, personal routine, exercise, food, sleep, all of that is really important to have the, you know, the words of Kahneman, the system two brain available at work versus system one animal brain. And the more that we are coming to work where we have access to our full brain, the better we can be in the choices we make with others.
So the whole idea of, you know, managing a virtual team, and I'm sure, I know you've done work in that area and I've heard you speak a little bit on that. Any tips that you would give a leader that is working with a virtual team just to keep them engaged and any thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, so the research and teaching for me on remote teams is very conclusive that remote teams are no different than face-to-face teams, but everything that goes wrong in a normal team blows up more quickly and more spectacularly in a remote team. So in a sense, remote work, it makes you good at teamwork. It forces it because you can't gloss it over. In person, if there's tension between two people in a room, you can see that immediately and fix it on the way out the door. In a remote team, you may not see it. You may not sense it. And then because people are more uninhibited online, and then when it does become a thing in the meeting, it's going to be a much bigger and uglier thing than it would have been in person. That being said, whatever the underlying tension was there in person as well. It just down blows up more quickly and worse. So basically for remote teams, it just means you have to get really good at leading teams, period. It's not a different skill set, but just means the things that you're sloppy or maybe not super intentional on, you have to do now. So if I think about it, like I often for teams, just like if you want a general diagnostic for yourself, if you go through that Michigan model color set and just think about, you know, a good leader is balanced across those four things. So is a team. And so if you go through the different colors, I call it for teams cope, you know, is my team coping? So yellow, you know, what is the people side of it? The culture for C, you know, how are the quality of relationships, you know? Wayne Baker and the Center for Positive Organizations have a lot of tools on this, but having positive relationships at work is critical. You also can think for me then about O, which is like the blue in the Michigan model of objectives, of clarifying like what is our goal. Like within my leadership center this summer, we took a lot of time to re-clarify what is our five-year goal as well as our quarterly goals, and are using objectives and key results now from the Doer book, Measure What Matters from Google. And having that level of clarity around goals has been a way to really align us as a team, which is especially needed in remote work. You know, every team needs aligned. You can kind of hold it together and micromanage in person, but when you're remote, you need to actually have it, you know, written down, visible. You know, we're using project management software with our OKRs to support that. P is processes. What are the structures? How do you run meetings? Have you actually taken the time to have a protocol for like what are best practices for a Zoom meeting for your company? You know, even in-person meetings would benefit from having clarity about what the norms are. Do we always have an agenda or not? Where do we find the meeting notes? Who runs meetings? And with Zoom meetings, it's not negotiable. You have to do that. So clarifying processes. And then the final one of COPE, of culture, objective, processes, and E is experimentation. So is our team actively experimenting? When's the last time someone tried something crazy? When's the last time we talked about hypotheses versus positions when we're making a decision? How can we build in a more adaptive and growth mindset oriented way of working with one another? Most teams struggle with one of these more than the others, and good teams are good at all four areas of coping, of culture, objectives, processes, and experimentation.
I was talking to a CEO this morning. She's been leading for, she's a seasoned executive, and she's talked about the issue of having Zoom calls and with teams and staff. And she said, I'm very good at reading people when I'm in the room with them. But she said, I've been really struggling with Zoom calls just because it is 2D. You don't get the same response as far as from somebody on the other side of a screen. Any thoughts around how to do that as far as to get a read and just how do you take the temperature? You mentioned that things online can go wrong quickly because you don't have that feedback that you sometimes get in person.
So formalizing communication processes, formalizing ways of working, so you can prevent things from going wrong by having clarity around your processes and objectives and really role modeling more of an experimentation mindset as a leader. If things do start to go wrong, though, and or like how do you manage in the moment in terms of reading the room, what I find is helpful is to have multiple means of communication with your team members. To be structurally planning in regular meetings where you take the pulse beyond just, you know, having the big decision meeting once a week, but also to have at the end of the week, like within our leadership center, every Friday we take half an hour, or the point of the meeting is just to check each other's temperature. And at the start of the meeting, everybody has to give a number for what their energy level is for the week. Mm. And we go around the room and share just so that you kind of, you know, the temperature in the room. So next week when we walk into a decision-making meeting and someone is more brittle than usual, you know, you knew it was coming because on Friday that person said, hey, with everything going on in the world, like this is just a hard week for me. Sure. And so then in the meeting, then I'm not only reliant on looking at the nonverbals, but like I had context about that person going in that makes it easier to understand what's going on and work through it. I'm also think that formalizing one-on-ones with direct reports right now is big. I know sometimes managers don't always take the time for it, but I think especially right now, you know, even if it's just a 10-minute check-in, you know, every 2 weeks, but taking the time to interact one-on-one is helpful. And then for us, in addition to like Zoom meetings, we've really leaned into GChat or Slack channels to communicate and to have different names for the channels to separate out the conversations. It's like one of our threads is a silly thread about a stuffed sheep that lived on a desk in someone's office in person. And so it's now rompers, stompers, and clompers. And whenever anybody has something private to share or like personal over, oh, this is a photo of me and my kids at the zoo this weekend or whatever, it goes in that channel. And for the people who don't necessarily want that type of conversation or connection, you don't have to open it. But many people right now do want that social context to understand how other people are feeling and just to have that little chit chat that helps you, again, read the nonverbals better. So we have our silly channel in addition to several project-based channels where we communicate quite a bit in between meetings. And just having multiple means of reaching one another and reaching one another about different things, not just work, has, I think, really helped our culture over the summer.
No, great ideas. I know you've done a lot around team dynamics and teamwork, and I read an article that you wrote for Fast Company, What Mountain Climbing Expeditions mm-hmm. Tell Us About Teamwork. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that concept? I know you did that. There was a while back that you wrote that, but I'd love to get your thoughts as people are working in teams and virtually.
Yeah, we were very excited. That author, which was led by Jennifer Chapman at Berkeley, was named the best article published in the field of management this year. Mm. Which was super exciting. That paper for me was really neat because the context of mountain climbing, of course, captures the imagination. But the part about that paper that I love the most is actually the underlying theory in it that we tested not only with the mountain climbing data, but also with this huge laboratory experiment. And especially right now, it's very timely. So the main underlying point of that paper was this idea when we're very collectivistic or very focused on the group, you know, say a team in the Michigan model that was very yellow. It was all about being nice, being positive, being supportive, and you didn't necessarily balance that out with anything else. Groups that are very collectivistic are blind to diversity. Like they literally don't even see that they're there. And so we show in this paper that particularly when you're looking at decisions where you benefit from knowing who the most expert person is in the room versus just thinking, oh, we're colorblind, we're all equal. But if you're taking a decision, especially around something like managing risk, it's important to know where the expertise is, and collectivism blinds you to that. And so we show in the Himalayan mountain climbing data that mountain climbing groups whose members came from more collectivistic countries on average had more fatalities because they were less good at identifying risk and choosing the safest way down the mountain because they just were blind to where the information was in the group because they're so focused just on the group. Interesting part, though, is if you look at outcomes where it's not about necessarily decision-making, but just keeping each other together, it can be helpful to ignore the diversity. And so the teams that were very collectivistic, mountain climbing teams, they were more likely to get all the members to the top and not have people give up halfway. They were more likely to keep the team together. But then at the same time, if something did go wrong, it was much worse. And they're more likely to have fatalities and grave injuries. And then we replicated this in a similar situation in the lab then, that if your only goal is cohesion and keep the team together, you know, say imagine a town hall meeting after a crisis in a company, it's fine to focus on the collectivism and the we, like, you know, all have the same color t-shirts, go company, you know, go blue at Michigan. That's very helpful then. But it's important then to also realize that now when you're back in your Zoom meeting and making a decision, collectivism is going to blind you to the differences that you need to see in order to make good decisions as an organization. And so as a leader then, how can you play with that, you know, and be playful and adaptive and not just always think that being a team and being similar and being collectivistic is the most important thing, but it's a message that you should use in some situations, but not others. And especially not when you're trying to make effective decisions or solve problems.
I know you've done a lot of work around startups and teams that work well. And I think I heard you say this, that 9 out of 10 startups typically fail.
Yep.
I think I heard you say that most of it's people issues that are the things that stand out.
Are people issues, according to Noam Wasserman. Yeah.
So as you're thinking about, you know, somebody that maybe is in a new role as a leader and they're thinking about people decisions, talk a little bit about your thoughts around that and what some of the data shows.
So I think the most important entry-level takeaway for that is to be intentional. At the end of the day, companies go under because of people issues. It's not, you know, people say, oh, we didn't get the financing we wanted, or our product didn't work. Well, okay, why? Well, somewhere in there was a decision made by people, made by the team. You know, everything that can and will go wrong is going to be determined by who's in the room and how well you're working together. And I think especially for whatever reason in the startup world, people are very inattentive to realize that that is your secret to success, is the people and how those people work together. So minimally, at least have it on your radar. You know, take the time to be thoughtful in your decision about your second hire as you are in the color of your landing page. You know, I've seen founders agonize for hours over what color of teal blue their landing page is. And yet when it comes to hires, like, oh yeah, I met that person at the networking event. They seem great. Like, let's hire them. I'm just like, wait, what? Like, no, not how this should be going. So to get intentional. And like, once you get intentional, then there's a lot of information out there about the different things you could be intentional about, whether it's having hiring practices that are free of bias and objective, of hiring in ways that goes beyond your immediate network. It could be intentional about how do you run meetings, or how do you do objectives and key results for your team each quarter, etc. And there's a whole lot out there, whether it's in, you know, you have Coursera courses and leading teams. You have great books out there, but I'm not going to get into like the 400 ways to lead teams effectively, but minimally just get intentional and start to learn. If you talk to VCs about like what sets apart like the truly great CEOs in Silicon Valley, the answer I get back a lot, which I just find is fascinating, is that they are voracious learners. And so maybe they didn't necessarily going in, you know, being the best people manager, but they're just naturally curious people who want to know and want to learn and keep on learning. And leadership and leading a company and the people skills that go with that, to me, is just like reading or math. It's a skill set anybody can learn and everybody should learn. But I think many people don't realize the importance of learning it as they do with something like reading, and they don't invest the daily time on it. But if you do start to, you know, for example, like with our senior leadership journey, get intentional about every day, I'm going to work on my behavior, I'm going to get better, that's how your company is going to succeed, is that level of intentionality and willingness to grow as a leader in this domain.
So speaking of learning and growing, are there books that you recommend to your students or people that are wanting to grow as a leader?
Sure. There's a few authors where I'd recommend the books, as well as just like their Twitter accounts for daily little tidbits. Bob Sutton at Stanford. I love his book, Good Boss, Bad Boss. It's probably my favorite leadership book. Hermione Ibarra, Ibarra. She's at London Business School now. It's a book on leadership and identity of Think Leader. It's wonderful. I also like Adam Grant's work, and obviously his, you know, podcasts and his social media are, at least for me, still daily sources of inspiration. For me, at least, and when I think about leadership, I like to read Adam's book, Give and Take, next to Jeffrey Pfeffer at Stanford's book, Power, because they're both very different tools. You know, like Adam's work is very much in like, how do I use generosity as a way to build positive relationships that help me as a leader. And Jeff's book on power is very much more like the dark Machiavellian side, but you need both tools. And if I read them next to one another, it helps me understand how I can be more adaptive as a leader personally. I'll stop there on leadership specifically. I also think that leading diverse teams right now is especially timely and important. And there's been a lot of great books in the last couple of years that have come out around that. And my favorite one there is Dolly Chu, C-H-U-G-H, How Good People Fight Bias, with the moral of the story being there's no such thing as good people. All of us are growing and trying to be better, and all of us make mistakes daily. So the sooner you can accept that, the sooner you can start growing. And I think that has implications, of course, beyond just bias. I also love the book Biased by Jennifer Eberhardt at Stanford. On this, Occlusify by Stephanie Johnson, and How to Be Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi.
So outside of work, is there anything that you do that recharges you? What do you do outside of teaching and consulting?
I'm a fanatical dressage rider. So dressage, think ballroom dancing with a horse.
Okay.
And very so cool. Much of that is leadership, communication, intentionality, teamwork. But then in a way that when you're in the moment, it feels like a hot team at work, where there's a sense of flow, of energy, of power and creativity in the same way, you know. And so it's on a good day on a horse with dressage when you're dancing, it's, you know, whether you like fast cars or skiing or something, but it just, there's this immense energy that comes with it. And then when you're truly working together in collaboration, that flow, like all of that together, you know, it's music and beauty and joy. I love it. There's a leadership class at Stanford on using horses for leadership, because horses are the best ever mirror. For your energy. And so if you come in insecure or in a bad mood, the horses won't work with you. And so at least for me, it's also a great way just to have a mirror of how I'm doing that day, and to make me check myself to say, hey, I need to be self-aware if I'm in a bad mood, because I bring that into my team. This horse is just telling me already that I need to do a check for myself. So yeah, many reasons to love it.
Yeah. Interesting. I raised Arabians growing up. So I enjoyed horses. Actually, you're the first guest out of 63 podcasts that has mentioned horses. So that's a new one. So that's great. Any parting advice you would give a leader?
Be intentional about how you work with your people, and experiment each day with ways to be better.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate your thoughts. I know this is going to be helpful for people listening, and wish you success this school year and all that you're doing.
Thank you, and thank you for having me on today.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.